The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, everyone, and welcome to IMC, and those of you here and those of you who might be with us online. And a few announcements before we start. The first is that yesterday I put out on the table, the counter where the by the exit, a whole stack of the end-of-the-year fundraising letters. I don't know how delighted you are about receiving fundraising letters. But if you're delighted enough about receiving it from IMC, there's one there you can pick up. And I realized this morning that we've been doing fundraising letters for 25 years, end of the year. And the first time we did it was so we could be in the circumstance to buy a place like this building here. Many years later, it was so that we could have a retreat center and take care of it. And so all the kind of building and the kind of growing of IMC is a lot is attributed to those end-of-the-year fundraising letters. Anyway, so if you want to read what I wrote, I wrote the letter. You're welcome to take one, whether you donate or not. And then I won't be here next week. Max Erdstein will be here. And the next time I'm teaching here at IMC, but also, also online, will be a Saturday, December 10th. No, I guess I'm teaching the 7 a.m. that week. But I'm here alone then. But on December 10th, I'm doing a day-long that's offered through Insight Retreat Center. There's information for it. It's online. It's on Zoom. And its information is on it about it on the What's New section of the homepage of IMC if you're interested in doing a day-long from home or someplace. So, to give a talk. So imagine that you finally able to bring a friend along to hear a Dharma talk someplace. They've been resisting, not wanting to come, but you feel like they should really, learn about the Buddhism or something. And so they finally agree to come, and the Dharma teacher sits down and starts talking and announces, "Today, I'm going to give a talk about suffering and how important it is to address suffering." And in your mind, you're going, "Oh no, I finally got my friend here, and this is going to be like this. They're going to be turned off by this." And or imagine another time you bring another friend who finally willing to come, but they're kind of cynical about things, skeptical. And the Dharma teacher starts off by saying, "Today, I'm going to talk about happiness." And oh no, my friend is skeptical about all things about this, how saccharine Buddhism can be or spirituality, and probably they're going to talk about loving kindness, and my poor friend is never going to come back. So I don't know if any of you brought friends today, but today I'm going to talk about suffering and happiness. And then some of you can say, "Oh no, my friend." But I want to emphasize how important happiness is for the path of Buddhism, Buddhist practice. I think that it's underappreciated, that it's a path of happiness, and that orienting oneself on this path of Buddhism to see what you can do to become a happier person. Are there reasonable ways that you could orient yourself, navigate this world, so that you're a little bit happier and delighted with life, with yourself? And there are other ways that you can do the opposite. So I know some people might feel that it's very important to become wealthy by the time you're 29. And so you say, well, I'll be happy later. But this is not the time to be happy. Well, that's, you know, maybe, I don't know what that is about. But then you're not really cultivating the factors for this path of liberation that Buddhism champions, which has a lot to do with developing a very significant, useful, supportive, strategic sense of well-being. And then with that, addressing suffering. This is well known since the time of the Buddha. In fact, there's accounts of the Buddha giving Dharma talks where the first thing he did is he elated and inspired the audience. And then he taught them about suffering. So both, right? Not one or the other. So I wanted to read the description of how the Buddha prepared people so he could talk about suffering. When the audience was ready, receptive, free from the hindrances, elated, and confident, he expounded to them the teaching special to the Buddhas, suffering. It's a little bit more, but that's what you say it for now. So, you know, I don't know if I can manage to do that today, to all in one Dharma talk, to make you ready, receptive, free of hindrances, elated, and confident. But just the idea that that's kind of what the Buddha did. I think that when I was younger in life, especially when I came out of Zen practice, where it was mostly just about a direct penetration to the truth, to emptiness or something, I would have thought this was manipulative. You know, you're kind of playing with people's emotions, getting them elated and all that. We want the truth, like just deal with suffering directly or something. But I think that it can be helpful and useful and ethical to promote being happy without it being necessarily, manipulative or something, saccharine. And it's an important part of the path. So why not talk about it and emphasize its importance? So then there's also a teaching about meditation practice where at some point in meditation also to address suffering. I mean, that's kind of the specialty of Buddhism. However, in meditation there also, there's a description letting the meditation practice develop and prepare you for encountering your suffering by going through stages of happiness, of well-being. And there's a series of them. And it begins by doing something which evokes, or having something which evokes your gladness, your delight, your kind of a joy. And what is it that can be evocative of that? One of the primary one the Buddha talks about is something called sada, shraddha in Sanskrit, usually translated as faith. It could also be confidence. Some people come to Buddhism and they hear about suffering and the importance of it, but what they hear more importantly is there's a practice and a path that leads to the end of suffering, and they go, wow. Finally, I meet someone who's really talking about suffering as it is, without kind of painting it over or talking about something else. And they have a path, they have a practice for it. This is inspiring. I'm so glad to have found it finally. And so kind of a gladness wells up. Other people have a gladness or inspiration, kind of, I think of it as gladness and inspiration being closely related. They're inspired. I remember meeting people when I was a newer practitioner and seeing as people who had been practicing for a long time and being so inspired by them. So, wow, I've never met someone like this. They seem ordinary enough. They don't seem like they're putting on airs or being, you know, spiritually high in the clouds, But there's something about them that really inspired a kind of peacefulness and joy or something in myself. There's all kinds of ways, you know, to be inspired. One of the things that creates this gladness and joy that perplexed me when I first came across it in Buddhism was the idea that your own ethics could be a source of joy. Like, you know, because I didn't grow up with much. I wasn't particularly unethical, but it wasn't like a place, you know. And you know, I was just a hippie, and you know, we were kind of antinomian back then. You know, not into the hypocrisy of a lot of the commandments and rules and all that. And so when I heard about people who were joyful about their ethics, I thought, well, I kind of found mistrustful. And I'd heard that in when I went to Thailand, that's what Theravadan Buddhists could have. They were so delighted in their following the precepts. It gave them satisfaction and all that. And then I went to Thailand and I did a long retreat there, 10 weeks long. And to my surprise, about 7 weeks into it, I felt a kind of strange feeling inside. What is this strange feeling? And the best I could come up with words to describe it, I felt a kind of ethical purity. Wow, what is this? And it felt kind of delightful to have it. There was a joy to it. And I thought, oh, maybe that's what the joy is. To feel, you know, it's not like an evaluation or going through the checklist, say, well, I don't do that, therefore I should be happy. It was the source inside for ethics that was just inspiring to me. So the Buddha talks about this, that idea of something that inspires us, inspires gladness. And gladness is evaluative in nature. You have it's a conceptual. Oh yeah, I have this experience, I have this knowledge, I've touched into something. This is really good. And I'm so happy, so glad that I'm so inspired by this thing that I've come into contact with. Then as we're inspired, feel gladness, that's said to create momentum to practice. And when we practice, the excitement, the little bit of agitation of gladness begins to dissipate, but the engagement, finally, now I'm doing it myself. It's not just an idea. And as we do it, there's something about the engagement in meditation at some point that brings something called pitti, P-I-T-T-I. And I like to translate it as joy. Some people say, Gil, that's too sedated or too, you know, dampening it down. It's rapture. And then I just like to call it well-being. There's some kind of inner sense of, some people call it a thrill. It's a little bit energetic. It comes partly from, or very much from, starting to get concentrated as we practice. And as we get concentrated, there's something, maybe it releases, you know, serotonin or something in our system. But the point being that something, when things become harmonized in the mind, and a harmony between the mind and the body, and things are kind of working together without any stress, the mind or the heart begins evoking or bringing forth something very different than it can evoke when it's caught up in stressful thoughts and preoccupations and lost in thought. It's a kind of a joy, it's kind of a miracle that happens this way. Then as we practice further, the joy, being content with it, happy with it, being able to kind of put aside so many of the preoccupations we have because we're feeling this joy, something in the body has a chance to relax. A lot of the relaxation of the body has to do with finally being present for your experience. The body just wants to relax. If you just give the body half a chance, it'll relax. And some of us don't do that. And sometimes the tension in the body is unconscious. We don't even know we're carrying it. I was so surprised when I started to meditate to discover that I would feel more rested and more relaxed after I meditated first thing in the morning than when I woke up from sleep. I thought sleep was supposed to be the premier rest. But in fact, meditation allows something to rest deeper. And a lot of that had to do with just being present. The body wants to relax, to be calm. And so the body relaxes. As the body relaxes, that joy that we have gets quieter, settles. The energy or the excitement around it goes away. And it gets replaced with happiness, well-being. And that is usually not translated in energetic terms like rapture. It's more sublime. Some people actually translate this word, the Pali word, sukha, as pleasure, because it's a very deep, embodied sense of well-being that just feels such sublime pleasure everywhere. And then the Buddha goes on and says, with that sense of happiness, that's the condition that allows for some very deep concentration. If you're content already, if you're happy, if your body is happy, it's just nice to be here. Some people talk about it, and I feel like I'm home finally. This is safe. This is, you know, satisfying. This is better than watching Netflix. This is good. And so there's a deep satisfaction that allows something to settle more, to unify, to come together, which is a lot of what samadhi is, concentration, just deep, willing to settle here. And that deep settledness here in the present moment, with the mind at rest, the body at rest, provides a new vantage point, a new perspective. Just like the Buddha, when he gave these Dharma talks, people became ready, receptive, free of the hindrances, elated, and confident. That state of being that he evoked in people prepared them, they were ready, right? Receptive, prepared them to see and understand something in a new way. In fact, when he starts teaching about suffering to that audience, it isn't that they then believe something new. What happens when they listen to his teachings about suffering, the description is their Dharma eye opens. Some ability to perceive is available. A new perspective arises. In the meditation path, going through gladness, joy, relaxation, happiness, and samadhi, also gives the meditator a new perspective to see. And what is that? So imagine yourself really as contented and happy and satisfied as you've ever been without being sleepy. So you're just alert and present. Maybe you woke up and up from a wonderful nap. And nothing has to happen, nothing you have to do anything. And you do have thoughts that come through. But the thoughts are like wispy clouds that come through. You saw there's a thought that goes through and passes, and you're looking at the dust. I've done that in laying in bed after a nap, and the sunlight comes in. Wow, there's a lot of dust, and just watching the dance of dust in the sunlight, you know, or the speckles on the ceiling. My thoughts come and they go, and nothing is sticky, nothing is grabby. It's just kind of just really nice to be there. And then a thought arises about some really big challenge at work that's really distressing for me and anxiety-producing for me or something. And I see that thought, work challenge, coming up. But I'm so settled, so quiet, so peaceful. I say, oh, look, there's thinking about that work challenge. And then we feel a little compulsion arise somewhere, maybe in the chest, like, we've got to get involved with this anxiety. We've got to get... And you say, wait a minute. I don't have to be involved. I don't have to pick this up, this thought up. I can just let it go, let it pass through. And there's such a subtle place that you actually have some choice. Oh, I don't have to get involved in this now. And then it passes. And then you're back to the dust dancing in the light, which feels so good, just to have nothing to do and peaceful and content. And then you think about, and suddenly it's been 50 years or something, and suddenly this thoughts about your high school sweetheart comes up who spurred you, or whatever, what's the word? It's kind of left you suddenly or something, or and like suddenly the anger starts coming. 50 years ago, right? But you're in this very nice state, and you see, oh, look at that. It's fascinating that after 50 years I should feel this compulsion towards anger. Let's not get involved with that. I have better things to do today. And you have enough choice there to not get involved, and it passes. And you watch all this stuff come and go. Come and go. Wow. This is something. And then you wonder, you have this thought, how can I live with this kind of peace? How can I just go through my life this way so I don't get caught in these things that I always just get caught in? In fact, now that I think about it, I spend most of my days caught in something. I never realized that until I had this deep peace as you watch things come and go, watch the tendency to get involved, watch it begin and watch it end. I had no idea that I was so, and most of my day caught in things. No wonder I wake up in the morning still tense. And so you say, how can I live in such a way that I stay close to this peace? So you think about it, what would it take? And first thing occurs to you, well, I think keeping this perspective active for me, keeping the perspective where I see how things arise, see when they first appear, so that I can see them as an appearing phenomena with no more reality, no more substantiality than just as a thought, an idea, compulsion arising. And so I have a chance to see it pass, to let it go. Seeing that all things come and go, that's a good perspective. Okay, what else should I do? Well, I've noticed that when I do get really entangled in rich, juicy, good, painful, suffering ways, it's because I have being mean. I'm being greedy, wanting more sensual pleasures of all kinds. I'm a little bit cruel even. I mean, those are cognitively complicated activities of the mind to have those motivations. Let's not do those. Okay, that's the second thing. Let's avoid certain kinds of behavior and motivations. And then you think, what else? Well, I've also seen that it's cognitively complex and involves entanglement, takes me away from this kind of peace if I lie a lot. How about if I not lie? What else? I bet, it's never been an issue for me, but I bet that if I spend a lot of time killing people, stealing from people, and running around doing sexual misconduct, I think that also puts me into this more complicated cognitive world of that I have to kind of plan and hide and run around and escape and justify. That's complicated. So let's not do that. What else? Well, I've been involved in work that harmed people, that didn't do any good for this world. And that was so stressful for my mind. And I've been involved that didn't do things that were felt wrong to do in the world. And that felt so much better. Let's avoid work that causes harm. Is there anything else I should do? Well, I should really take a good look at myself. And I see this from this new perspective I have, I see that when these compulsions arise in the mind, like if greed arises or hatred arises or the kind of spinning around in confusion and delusion and perplexity, that actually doesn't feel good, then I'm kind of caught again. I've left that kind of relaxed place, watching things come and go. Let's not do those things. And I've noticed actually the opposite. There are certain ways that the mind operates and thinks about things, and where it's generous, where it's kind, where it's wise, that it comes so naturally. It seems to actually be part and parcel of this peaceful, satisfying, relaxed place that I discovered at the end of this path of gladness, joy, tranquility, happiness, and concentration. So let's stay close to those good things. What else should I do? I think I better stay attentive enough to track all this. I think I need to be mindful. Stay mindful. What else? Well, it seems that a lot of this new perspective is supported by being really settled, concentrated, still. Let me live a life in such a way that I have access to a quiet, concentrated, still mind. Great. What I just went through is the Eightfold Path. This is apparently what the Buddha did when he was enlightened. He did exactly the same analysis. What keeps me close to this freedom I discovered? And so, when the Buddha gave this talk, where he made people's minds receptive, free of the hindrances, elated and confident, he was putting their minds in a state that now was ready for a new perspective. And what was that new perspective? It was suffering, the arising of suffering, the appearance of suffering, the cessation of suffering. Remember, this is what happened after the nap. That you saw states of mind, thoughts, ideas arise and pass. And you saw compulsions to be involved in them come, and you chose not to be involved. Let it all come. Trust the simple mind. Relax. Don't get caught in anything. See the arising and passing, because if you get caught in it and involved, you won't see things come and go. There's freedom there, almost like between the ending of one thing and the beginning of the next. There's peace, there's space, there's something wonderful, almost like that. And then he taught them the path, sometimes called the path leading to the end of suffering. And this is the Eightfold Path. I like to think of it, the Buddha thought about it this way as well, that it wasn't so much leading to the end of suffering, it is, but it also is how to live from that place where there is that freedom, that ease. So, happiness has a role in Buddhist practice. Happiness prepares us to be able to see the world and ourselves in a new way. That's actually hard to do if we're suffering a lot. Buddhist practice can help people who suffer a lot, can give us practices and perspectives and compassion and all kinds of things that support the lessening with suffering, coming to having a better relationship to our suffering, finding our way with suffering. But at some point, this practice of Buddhism is also about awakening or staying close to developing our capacity for a significant kind of well-being. Happiness. How often in your day do you allow yourself to be happy? How often in the day are you so involved in serious things that you don't take the time to be delighted at what your circumstances are, the weather, the sky, the trees, the people around you? Maybe you have such important things to do that you can't really take the time to appreciate anything that's around you or with you. So I don't want to, if that, your life is that important, I don't want to interfere. But maybe for some of you, it's not. Some of the things you get involved in are not that important. If an anthropologist from Mars came to study you and looked at what you actually did through the day, what conclusion would they make about what human beings are all about? Would it be like the best news in the universe? Or would it be, well, maybe you should have chosen someone else? Because the way my mind works, I'm always caught up in this and that and involved in this or that and being resentful. Or so when they report back to Mars, they say, this person mostly spends their time thinking about the past. Or they write back to Mars and say, this person is mostly planning because they're always anxious. Maybe that's what human life is on the planet Earth is all about, being anxious. A lot of those people are anxious, so they must have, I think it's a religion of anxiety. They must worship it. You should see what they do. And they have this special altar, this sacrament they go to regularly in which to kind of increase their level of anxiety. They're really good at it. It's a monitor. And so I think that for, not for anyone here, of course, but there are people for whom what we do in daily life regularly and repeatedly would not be the best representation for what human beings are capable of if the anthropologist from Mars reported about us. I would propose that some of us don't have such important things to do all the time that we can't take more time to feel happy, to feel joyful, to feel appreciation, to find things that are inspiring. Is that Pollyannish? Is that saccharine life? Is that a life then that doesn't realize that this is a serious world we're in? There's a lot of people suffering and we have to get grim quickly. Or we are serious about the degree of suffering there is in the world. There's a lot. It's heartbreaking what goes on in this world. But maybe, just maybe, we are better off with a new perspective about it all in addressing it than the old perspective. To have the Dharma eye open. And that's what the Buddhism is about. And to have this Dharma eye open, to be able to see in a new way, to see from the perspective of how things are coming and going, moment by moment, to see from a place of well-being, subtleness, happiness. And then from there, let us address the suffering of this world. Let's not ignore it. Let's not just be happy and then forget everyone else. So the importance of happiness, and that the Eightfold Path is a recipe for that happiness, staying close to it, the happiness of this new perspective. And it's kind of a cycle. That if you feel the happiness of this new perspective, that strengthens the gladness, the joy, the tranquility, the happiness, and the ability to see things as they are better, which can produce more happiness, more feeling of this is being inspired. And so it grows and grows. So, today's talk was about happiness and suffering. And the point I wanted to make was the importance of happiness. I don't say it's easy to be happy, but it might be more available to you than you allow yourself to take advantage of or to touch into. And if you allow yourself to have more happiness, perhaps it'll allow your meditation to become more settled, more contented, more concentrated, so that it isn't just dust dancing in sunlight that you see coming and going, but there's a profound way of seeing this world as coming and going, and you free in the midst of it. So, those are my thoughts for today. And we have a few minutes here. We can take maybe a couple of questions if someone would like to ask or comments about this or anything. And then afterwards, we can take some time and go outside in the parking lot, those of you would like to. Join me out there. We'll put chairs in a circle and we can continue our discussion. And out there, you can also take off your mask if you want.
Okay, it's better. Gil, early in the talk you mentioned serotonin, and I think that leads to a body chemistry kind of question. I have this idea, but that I'm not sure about, that any kind of getting what we want kind of activity stimulates some body chemistry, serotonin or adrenaline or hormones, that feels a lot like happiness. But maybe they have the seeds of some stress. Maybe this body chemistry that gets stimulated has the seeds of stress underlying them, and that the greatest happiness, the kind of a dharmic happiness, would be the kind of happiness that tamps down our body chemistry so that there's not strong emotions happening. Instead, there's just kind of like pure awareness and a letting go. Does that bringing body chemistry into the Dharma like I'm doing now, does that make sense to you?
I'm not qualified to answer. I mean, I shouldn't have brought up serotonin. I hardly know what it is.
Well, that's what I was asking you, because I don't know either.
And so, you know, to answer questions about body chemistry is something I'm not really capable of doing. But I think that from a classic Buddhist point of view, there's a difference between the mental, emotional, physical activity that we're engaged in, which leaves traces, and those that doesn't leave traces. And so the traces what those traces are that are not helpful for us, not useful for us, the negative karma, in a sense, Buddhism talks about karma being left behind. And so maybe it's just chemicals that are, you know, stuck in our system. But there are good chemicals too. There's good states of mind that can get quite strong and persist and create very different conditions that persist. And whether this practice makes us kind of emotionally neutral, dampens down our emotions, I think it's a, it's a, um, It depends on the person. There are people whose emotions swing between very dramatic states of well-being and very dramatic states of suffering, emotions of suffering, despair, and all kinds of things, that are directly connected to what they're clinging to, directly connected to their attachment to self-identity. And so for those people, as their clinging reduces, the swings won't be as much. The other people who cling, and the way they cling narrows the range which they have. They're not going to budge. They're going to be frozen, kind of like, and just maybe they'll smile. You know, and so they're dampened down. And for them, as they relax, they're clinging, they begin having a much wider range. What the right range is for people is very individual. And there shouldn't be any comparison to others. What the only thing is, get out of the way and don't add clinging to make it worse.
This helps. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, maybe one more, if you have any. So, Bill, in the corner.
Thanks. Thank you for the talk. It's so nice to be here. This is my first time back since it's the shutdown. So I just got through watching a Global Joy Summit. It was a multiple-day thing. It had speakers from all sorts of, you know, from contemplative sciences and neuroscience and different spiritual leaders, and it was really amazing. And it started with a documentary that is available to everybody, where Desmond Tutu and Dalai Lama, if you look for them and joy, it comes up. And it's just really timely what you're talking about, also with the Eightfold Path well on its way here. But one of the biggest things, because both of them have gone through such tremendous suffering, their countries have, and they have, but to see the two of them together was really remarkable. They were like lovers. They couldn't keep their hands off of each other. And it was, I guess, what I took away from that and today, it's not about denying suffering at all. Absolutely not. These people, these two leaders absolutely faced it. But it's almost like a choice to purposely make space for joy and to see it, to see the opportunities for it, to claim it in a sense when it's available. I guess that's what I took away from it. It's in no way is it meant to deny the suffering at all. It's more of a purposeful claiming of joy. Is that about in line with what you're saying? Or?
I think it's close enough. I think I like what you're saying. I feel a little hesitant about claiming it. It seems a bit strong.
Okay.
But I think that there are all kinds of ways in which there are people out in the world who are trying to make you miserable. I mean, terrorists, for example, and politicians and all kinds of people. And it's a revolutionary act to not buy into it. And it's a revolutionary and powerful act not to give in to fear, not to give in to anger, when there's a lot of people coming at you with giving you reason or ordinary motivation to be that way. So to appreciate how radical it is to stay happy, but how to do it so it's genuine is the art. There's so many people who do it in a fake way, who do it as a veneer. And that doesn't help either. So I think meditation is one of the means by which to keep it sincere or authentic for ourselves. Because if you're really practicing mindfulness and being present, you'll feel that the veneer doesn't work. The pretending doesn't work. or the insistence. But I think that I believe that the examples you give are fantastic examples of people who have stood up against the suffering and the evil of this world and demonstrated an alternative in such a way that inspired people to live a different way. So yes, so please, if you want to change this world in a very good way, be happy. Please. And it's not easy for those of you who struggle with this topic. I don't want to pretend that it's easy, but it's really worthwhile to be on this path. And there is a path that you can take. And sometimes the path is slow, but it's really worthwhile. And knowing you're on a path is one of the recipes for at least gladness, if not for joy. So thank you very much. And those of you who'd like to stay, we'll go. There's folding chairs in the little cabinet just around the corner there in the other room. Take one with you outside, and then we can meet outside and continue our discussion. Thank you.